Welcome to The Greek Current, a podcast by Halk and Kathimerini. I'm your host, Thanos Davelis. Today we're heading to Washington, D.C., where the U.S. Supreme Court recently turned down Turkey's bid to dismiss two lawsuits against it filed by demonstrators in the now infamous attack by Turkish President Erdogan's bodyguards that took place at Sheridan Circle in 2017 against U.S. protesters. Andreas Akaris, an attorney from the firm Bergman, Burbert, Schwartz & Gilday, who also represents the anti-Erdogan protesters, joins me to break down what the Supreme Court decision means in the effort to hold Turkey accountable for the attack at Sheridan Circle and look at what comes next in this landmark case. Andrea, welcome back on The Greek Current.
Thank you, Thanos. Good to be back.
Andreas, was there ever any doubt about this Supreme Court decision?
You know, look, anytime you're dealing with courts and anytime you're dealing with the Supreme Court, and particularly when you're dealing with foreign countries and substantial foreign countries that they're really not sort of in the eye of American foreign policy as an enemy, but a country that you would like to have great relations with and raise their stature in the context of NATO. And that's what you're dealing with when you're dealing with Turkey. So do I think from a legal standpoint and the positions taken and the facts at hand and the facts of the case, did we have any doubt? No, we were pretty confident that we would prevail. But, you know, as any attorney knows, you always make room and consideration for the possibility that what you expect does not come to fruition.
Andreas, can you give our audience just a brief recap of the incidents at Sheridan Circle in 2017 and how this is still impacting the victims who've brought this case forward?
Right. So May 16, 2017, President Erdogan had visited Washington at the invitation of President Trump. The two of them had a bilateral meeting in which they discussed a series of different foreign policy issues that affect or of interest to Turkey and the United States. And one particular topic of conversation that still continues to create sore points between the Ankara-Washington relationship is that of the Kurds. And particularly at that time, the United States had armed the YPG with what they call heavy weapons, so things above the capacity of a machine gun, in which the YPG is a very known ally or coalition partner of the United States in beating back ISIS in Syria. The position of Turkey has always been that the YPG is a terrorist organization and one that threatens the Turkish state. Whether that's true, whether that's false, that's the position of Turkey. And so when it appears that the ambitions of President Erdogan were not met during his visit, his goals, which was probably to minimize the U.S. YPG role as much as he could, and he didn't accomplish that, he was not in a good mood. There were many protesters that had assembled outside of the White House who were protesting Erdogan's presence. And they ranged from, you know, there were Greeks, there were Kurds, there were Armenians, and there were any slew of people who were protesting him for his anti-democratic policies, whether they be what we call ethnic Turks or what people call ethnic Turks and American pro-democracy individuals. So you had a lot of protest. And some of those protesters made their way down to an area known as Sheridan Circle, which is a public space smack in the middle of Embassy Row here in Washington, where all the embassies are arrayed. And right across the street from Sheridan Circle is the residence of the Turkish ambassador. The protesters went there because they had a hunch that President Erdogan would either go to the Turkish ambassador's residence or the Turkish embassy, which was just a little further along the way from Sheridan Circle, but you can see it from Sheridan Circle, essentially. So President Erdogan's guards were lined up outside of the residence. Protesters were making their protest. President Erdogan's guards simply couldn't stomach a democratic protest. They were slowly becoming angry and reaching a boiling point. There were insults being hurled back and forth. And then at some point near the arrival of President Erdogan to the Turkish ambassador's residence, things were reaching more of a fever pitch. And then an order was given upon the arrival of President Erdogan. An order was given, it appears, from what cameras and audio equipment picked up, that the protesters be attacked. Dalin Dior was the Turkish term used, which means dive in. Abi Dalin Dior, so you can hear the Turkish guards communicating with each other that he says attack. Brother, he says attack. And so the attack was unleashed against these protesters. It was brutal. And at the same time, the Turkish guards knocked over and roughed up a lot of metropolitan Washington, D.C. police. And there was a lot of security present from U.S. Secret Service agents, both uniformed and plainclothes, special security detail that handles intelligence. Anytime we have a foreign dignitary present in the U.S. There's also an intelligence component of the Secret Service and our uniform Metropolitan Police Department. So anyway, you had a big, big brawl in which the Turkish security just beat and pummeled the protesters. And at that point, the rest kind of became history. We contacted, were retained. There's a group of attorneys. We're working together. And we've been pursuing this case ever since.
Turkey had argued, Andreas, that U.S. law shields foreign countries from most lawsuits. But this decision affirms that Turkey does not have legal immunity here. Is this an important precedent being set and, by extension, a clear message to Erdogan and any who would try to emulate him as well?
Yes. The answer is yes. The Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is the means by which you bring a lawsuit against a foreign country in the United States. And generally, in the FSIA, there's essentially sovereign immunity and you cannot sue a foreign country, but for some exceptions. And an exception applied here, that's torturous conduct, wrongful conduct, harmful conduct, in which you cause, in this case, personal injury, assault, battery, and other things like hate crimes. And it does send a strong message because, I mean, an important point is we probably have about 2,000 to 2,500 diplomatic visits to Washington, D.C. annually, and that's over the course of decades. And an incident like this truly has never happened of this scale and this size. You've had guards push back and forth with individuals, but a full-scale attack like this, no. So it's unprecedented. Washington doesn't want this. Congress doesn't want this. The White House doesn't want this, and the courts don't want it. And it's a very strong message, yes.
With this decision, the lawsuit essentially can proceed as planned. What comes next?
So what is supposed to come next? Supposed to, and I emphasize supposed to, because we really don't know how Turkey's going to conduct themselves. Their primary mode of litigation thus far has been delay. And at some points, what they put forth is rib-tickling funny. You know, they're just, it's inane. The next step is Turkey's attorneys are to meet and confer with us. The meet and confer is the initial step for laying out the plan of how the litigation will be prosecuted, right? How many witnesses do you expect to depose? How many do we expect to depose? How many days do you think for trial? When do you think we should go to trial? A very basic administrative function. Thus far, Turkey has refused to participate in the meet and confer. The deadline is November 4th. So that's one. Turkey has refused to file an answer. We filed a suit against Turkey, and it's been now more than 3.5 years, probably more than 4 years, and Turkey still hasn't filed an answer. So essentially, Turkey has yet to acknowledge the jurisdiction of the Federal District Court. The only participation Turkey has had in this litigation is to contest jurisdiction. So it remains an open question whether they will even participate in this litigation, since that means that they would honor the decision of the Supreme Court and accept the jurisdiction of the U.S. Federal District Court.
What would that mean then if, you know, they cut and run, for example, as you've laid out on Twitter?
Yeah. So if they fail to show up, we would still proceed by affirmatively presenting our case. And obviously, if there's no defendant there, you're going to draw a series of adverse inferences, meaning the court would simply say, okay, Turkey is aware of this case and chose not to defend it. And here's the evidence. And we have the video and we have the testimony and we have the arguments of attorneys. And so, you know, this inference goes against Turkey. And by the end of the presentation of our case in chief, we would end up with a default judgment, whatever that may be.
And then, while holding Turkey accountable in civil court is obviously damning for Ankara, what about the individuals who were directly responsible for this attack? Have they gotten off scot-free, or, you know, does the U.S. have tools to hold them accountable as well?
So, yes, you would have tools. The question is how things have transpired from the date of the incident to today. So there were 17 individuals, I believe, on the Turkish side that were criminally charged. Two individuals are Turkish nationals who became either American citizens or legal permanent residents here in the United States. So they were not security guards or agents of President Erdogan directly employed by Turkey, as far as we know, but individuals who had gone to the Turkish ambassador's residence to show support for President Erdogan. And when the security detail or these agents unleashed their attack, these two individuals decided to join in. They were arrested and they each served about a year in jail, right? So they were criminally charged. They entered a plea bargain because obviously they knew they wouldn't prevail. Then 15 guards were criminally charged, but the Trump administration dropped charges against 11 in sort of unexpected way and under sort of dubious circumstances. because on the eve of then Secretary Rex Tillerson's travel from Washington, D.C. to meet Erdogan in Turkey, that evening they dropped charges against another 7 individuals. So in total, bringing the drop charges to 11. So during the Trump administration, we saw a less, to put it mildly, less vigorous effort to hold these guards accountable. We still have charges against 4 or 5 of them. And if they were to step foot in the U.S., they would have to be arrested and charged.
Andreas, I'm going to ask you to take your legal hat off and put on your politics cap, you know, because you have experience on the Hill. Looking at the broader impacts of the attack at Sheridan Circle, this incident revealed to Congress and the American people exactly what Erdogan's Turkey stands for. Would you say this marked a major turning point in U.S.-Turkish relations, particularly when it comes to Congress?
I would say that most people in the American government apparatus know what the limitations are in the U.S.-Turkey relationship, right? Those who know, not those who just have a conversation about it. So people at State Department, people at CIA, people in the Defense Department, and members of Congress who are involved in foreign affairs, I don't think that anyone can truly deny the sort of authoritarian, not just trope that Erdogan puts out, but orientation of Turkish government today. But I believe, and I think it's more than a belief, it's kind of self-evident, that the United States holds Turkey in a position of importance, geostrategic importance. So the relationship really is a transactional one, rather than sort of the other NATO allies in which the vision of the West is a shared vision and the ideas are shared values. Turkey's sort of an interloper. I mean, I would liken Turkey to a team member who's not a good team player. And that's how people, I think, in Washington view it. Now, this specific case, directly respond to your question, is so obnoxious and offensive that it's simply not defensible by any well-adjusted, normal-thinking political figure here in the United States. And so it is more than impulsive and a knee-jerk reaction to condemn Turkey for what happened at Sheridan Circle, but to clearly demand that they be held accountable because it's just an egregious crossing the line. And in fact, Thanos, the Biden administration filed 2 briefs in the course of this litigation, and in both made it clear that Turkey should be held accountable. And the Solicitor General was even more clear, signifying that this is not something that we should be concerned with in the context of foreign policy, that the relationship in foreign policy is what it is, and this breach of the law on American soil is what it is, and it needs to move forward for litigation.
Andreas, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to chatting again.
Thank you, Thanos.
In other news, President Erdogan announced Turkey's plans to drill for hydrocarbons in its maritime zone, as well as on land and sea in third countries. We have the capacity to go with our ships to third countries that possess natural gas reserves to drill, get the gas, and jointly sell it to other countries. We have requests from several countries. Libya is first in line, Erdogan said. Greece is warily eyeing Turkey's intentions to drill south of Crete in areas that form part of Greece's EEZ. While Erdogan took a rare break from attacking Greece on Thursday, his defense minister claimed that it is Greece itself that is expansionist, although he also said he was always ready for a dialogue. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on Thursday increased pressure on Turkey to greenlight Sweden and Finland's accession to the alliance, declaring during a visit to Istanbul that Stockholm and Helsinki have delivered and should be allowed in. The delay has raised questions about Turkish President Erdogan's political strategy and whether he is using the issue of NATO accession as a bargaining chip in Ankara's complex relationship with the United States, as well as to boost his own popularity at home. Mevlut Cavusoglu, the Turkish foreign minister, acknowledged that Sweden and Finland have made progress but said that more needs to be done. Finally, the latest data shows that Turkish airspace violations against Greece for the year 2022 are currently at 8,880. This is more than the total numbers for both 2021 and 2020 combined. These numbers are a clear indicator of Turkey's increasing aggressive stance in the Aegean, which are targeted against a NATO ally. This is why a wide coalition, including HALC, is conducting the No Jets for Turkey campaign. Follow the link in our show notes to learn more about this effort and to take action. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.